One thing, and there are many, but one thing I like about Scotland is there's a certain amount of respect afforded to authors. More than just monuments and statues to a country's great thinkers, there are often days set aside just to celebrate their lives and their work. One of those days involves a lot of whiskey and haggis, but on today's podcast, we're going to talk about Edinburgh's Robert Louis Stevenson. Books like Treasure Island and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde continue to have resonance and remain part of the popular conscience over 100 years since they were written. So what makes an author like Robert Louis Stevenson, and what attracts people to his work and life? During Robert Louis Stevenson Day at the Storytelling Center here in Edinburgh, I got a chance to speak with Jeremy Hodges. Jeremy is a journalist who's recently completed a huge biography of Stevenson with some exciting insights to this legendary author's life.
Hello, everybody.
It's the multicolored cultural laser. We travel the world for the boys and the girls. Casting pots of wonder and amazement. Multicolored cultural laser.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Hodges. I'm the author of Lamplit Vicious Fairyland, which is downloadable free at the Robert Louis Stevenson website.
Louis or Louis?
Louis, spelt Louis as in the French way, but pronounced Louis in the Scottish way. There's an S on the end of it.
So let's do it right. It's Robert Louis Stevenson Day here, and we're hanging out at the Scottish Storytelling Center. And you've just completed this biography of Robert Louis Stevenson. Can you tell us a little bit about what's been happening today to celebrate Robert Louis Stevenson Day?
Well, as far as we're concerned, the members of the Robert Louis Stevenson Club, which has been going since 1920, decided that we were going to be doing an all-day reading here at the Scottish Storytelling Centre. And rather than go over familiar books, last year we did Treasure Island, we thought this year we would do his short stories and poems, and not necessarily the obvious ones like Jekyll and the Hyde. We're doing ones, we've done A Lodging for the Night, which is set in medieval France. We're doing The Body Snatcher, a very grim and gruesome tale. We're doing Markheim, which he wrote round about the same time as Jekyll and Hyde. It's sort of like a complimentary horror story, if you like. And 9 of us are doing The Pavilion on the Lynx, which is set on the coast near North Berwick at Darlton. We've also had Todd Lapraig, which is a tale in Scots. Of course, I mustn't forget, at the start of the day, Louise Welshower, our celebrity reader, if you like, the novelist, gave us Thrawn Janet. So we've been doing well with poems in between, poems, love poems, and right at the moment they're doing extracts from A Child's Garden of Verses, so it's very much a mixed bag.
It's always surprising when you hear about that there is a Robert Louis Stevenson Society that was started in 1920. What was it about that time?
One of the sort of driving forces, if you like, was the fact that there were still people, early members of the club, who had known Stevenson when he was in Edinburgh. And they wanted to keep his memory alive. Wasn't exactly dying. I mean, his books were still being read, but they wanted them to be read further, which has always been the club's mission, if you like. It was fellowship as well, sharing Stevenson with other people who were interested in it. But one of the first things they did, one of their club members, a lady called Rosalind Masson, whose sister had, she'd actually been engaged to Louis Stevenson. That's the secret that isn't usually passed about. But she decided that because there are all these people who had known Stevenson and who were by then getting in later life, that their memories ought to be connected before they got lost. So she went round, and it was like a social history exercise. She got dozens and dozens of people to write down their memories of Robert Louis Stevenson. And she put them into a book called, would you believe, I Can Remember Robert Louis Stevenson. It ranges from the most banal things like I knew Stevenson, didn't think of him very much, can't really remember much about him, through to the most wonderful descriptions of what he was like and the things he did, all the amateur dramatics. He was part of an amateur dramatics club in Edinburgh. So this was the sort of thing that the club wanted to keep going. And we also set up the first Stevenson Museum, which was in Howard Place. Sadly, eventually, I think it wasn't financially viable, but all the collection from it went into the Writers' Museum in Edinburgh, where you can still see it and enjoy it.
And what is it that attracts you as an expert, I guess, as a biographer, as somebody who's researched Stevenson a lot? Is your primary interest in his work, or are you intrigued equally by his character and the reactions people had to him and his adventures in and around the world?
It's the life, actually. I came to Stevenson for a very curious viewpoint. Until I started looking at him, I'd read Treasure Island. I don't even think I'd read Kidnaps. I was familiar with The Child's Garden. But really, I hadn't read a lot of Stevenson at all. I was working as a journalist, and one of the things I used to do was profile interviews with celebrities, if you like. And on the odd occasion when there wasn't a living person available to interview, I would make a speciality of writing feature articles about dead people who had interesting lives. It became quite a joke in the office, you know, who's the dead person we're digging up this week?
So who would you have?
At the time of Stevenson's, the centenary of Stevenson's death in 1994, the Sunday Times wanted to run a fairly big feature on Stevenson, just, you know, as a set piece, because this was a milestone. And they wanted something that hadn't been looked at so much before, so they sent me off to find something, dig up something different about Stevenson. And having read a biography or two, I got interested in this story of Kate Drummond, the girl he allegedly met in a brothel, and who people were falling over themselves to dismiss as a myth, and of course it was a joke. And I thought, well, was it? And I looked at the chap who'd written about her, and I looked at his credentials. He actually knew two of Stevenson's best friends when he was a young man, so the provenance was good. And he said quite categorically that he had met this person who had told him about Kate Drummond, who had seen her, what she looked like, and all the rest, and that Stevenson had met her in a brothel, and that he had wanted to marry her. But that's understandably, his parents had cut up rough. His father had gone into a rage and told him that if he didn't stop having anything at all to do with the girl in future, he would be thrown out of the house without a penny. And under extreme parental pressure, the story was that Lewis caved in, and that was the end of it. The only hard evidence we have for this, you won't find Kate Drummond cropping up in letters, but he did admit that at one point he had a whole lot of letters sent to him from a girl, and he said this was a girl who would have struggled to find the postage for it. She wasn't a nice, middle-class, wealthy American girl who wouldn't have thought twice about postage stamps. So she was a girl in restricted circumstances, and she'd even bought a cheap bit of letter paper for the first one with a flower on the top of it. And he hadn't answered any of these because he didn't want them to keep coming. And in the end, he felt so guilty about it that he burnt the lot. So if he hadn't confessed that in one letter, we'd know nothing about it.
So that must have been... How did you find that one letter that he... Where did that turn up?
It was just sitting in the 8 volumes of his letters. So if you go through 2,800 and something other, it's in there somewhere.
That's an incredible piece of reporting.
Biography is like this. You're looking for here, there, and everywhere, finding little bits of jigsaw puzzle and trying to fit them together. And you get quite excited when you get a new bit, because you then find it clicks in with another bit, and it then clicks in with another bit, and the story just sort of builds. And there's a lot of that in Stevenson's life. So going back to my original article that I wrote, having written that, I had more questions than I had answers. And so I went on and I wanted to do more, and I was doing other articles for newspapers. I was a freelance, so you know I needed to come up with ideas to sell. So I'd come up with something new about Stevenson. And it just grew and grew and grew and grew. And eventually I thought, you know, this, the only way I'm going to get this out of my head is to do the full Monty, do a biography.
I love the fact that you came to doing a biography through this kind of reporting, this journalistic way. It's a really interesting way to go into it. What were some of the questions?
The other interesting, the interesting thing from my point of view was that having not read all that much Stevenson beforehand, I then went and read through his books and short stories and other bits and pieces. But with the eye of a biographer, I was always asking, what does this tell me about him? What does it tell me about his life? When you see these characters with the names, who's he naming them after? Who's the inspiration? You know, what was the reality that triggered all these works of imagination?
And then, of course, you're cross-referencing him with letters and bits of conversation about him.
And, of course, he wrote a novel called Katrina, whose heroine is Katrina Drummond, which is Gaelic for Kate Drummond. And you also find in the story of Katrina, the novel, all kinds of parallels and similarities with the story that was told by the biographer about this real girl allegedly real girl called Kate Drummond. So everything starts clicking and fitting, and you get quite excited when this happens. And we've mentioned Flora Masson. Apparently, he was engaged to her, but then he went off to France and he met Fanny Osborne, the American lady, married lady, that he fell in love with there, and he ended up chasing her over to America, and in California persuading her to divorce her husband, who was profoundly unfaithful. And eventually they got married, and somewhere along the way, Flora Masson faded into the background. And the only reason that we know they were engaged was one little tiny piece of evidence, a comment from somebody who used to be her neighbor down in London. She, having not married Lewis Stevenson, she decided to become a nurse, and she went down to London and she trained with Florence Nightingale. She was one of the first wave of proper nurses. In London, she lived in Hampstead, and a neighbor of hers in Hampstead revealed years later that Miss Flora Masson might, had she wanted, have been Mrs. Robert Louis Stevenson, and then that the letter of proposal was still in existence. And you think, wow, where is it? Lost. We don't know now. But the guy who said it was William Robertson Nicol, who was editor of the British Weekly. He was a thoroughly responsible and truthful person, and he would not have given you a lot of moonshine. And that's the only way that we know that Louis Stevenson was engaged to Flora Masson.
And that somewhere out there, in somebody's drawer or something, there's this letter.
Might be.
This proposal might be.
I don't have it. I wish I did.
Yeah, it'd be really valuable. Can you tell me just some of the other questions that were thrown up? You said that when you were writing these articles about the first main article about Stevenson.
Catherine Stevenson, his best friend in his youth was Bob Stevenson, his cousin Bob, who was a brilliant talker. Didn't write anything down, hated writing, but brilliant, brilliant, witty talker. People who knew him said he was more entertaining, more witty than Oscar Wilde. And this was people who knew Oscar Wilde and Bob Stevenson.
It's pretty good.
Bob was better. But because Bob never wrote anything down, it's all lost, it's all gone. But Bob and Catherine, his younger sister, used to go on holiday down in the borders with Lewis. And Lewis mentioned in the corner of an essay about popular authors years later that he'd had a teenage romance down in the borders on the banks of the River Tweed. And it looks like the girl in question was his cousin Catherine, who was then just 13. I think it was just a summer romance on his part, although I think she probably carried a candle for him thereafter. She got married eventually to a chap called Sidney de Matos, who scandalized the family because he admitted to being an agnostic. And in the Stevenson's book, this was tantamount to horrible atheist. You know, you didn't admit that you didn't believe in God in Victorian times. This was shocking. She was determined to marry him. She did. And sure enough, according to, you know, just as the relatives feared, after she had had two children in quick succession, her husband started going with other women. And she ended up locked in this unhappy marriage. But she wasn't prepared to put up with it. So she ran away to France, taking her little daughter with her. The baby was still at home. She left her husband literally holding the baby with the help of a nurse. And she ran off to France. But what she mentions in her entry in this book, I can remember wrote Lee Stevenson, that other biographers seem to have missed, is she says when she was in France with her little daughter, Lewis Stevenson was with them. And they were staying together in the little town of Le Monastier before he went on his journey with Travels with a Donkey. You read Travels with a Donkey, you think he's on his own, you know. Doesn't talk about his cousin and his little niece being his little second cousin or whatever being with him.
Interesting omission.
Doesn't mention living with them in France before they went and all the rest. Why not? Because it was scandalous. He might have been her cousin, but she had run away from her husband, and for her to be living with another man, having left her husband, was deeply, deeply scandalous. And when Lewis got back from France after he'd done his journey, he was writing to his mother and to his friend, who was also his lawyer, saying, for God's sake, don't say where I am. Don't give my address. Because he was afraid he was going to get a writ. He was going to get cited as correspondent in a divorce action. And fortunately, the crisis passed, and that was that. Catherine was quite a remarkable woman. She wanted to be a writer herself, but not with so much success. She wrote journalism. She did reviews and things like that, supported herself like that after she finally did divorce her husband. And after Lewis got married, she had a sort of an uneasy friendship with his wife. and she would go and stay with them down in Bournemouth, where they then had a house. She was keen on horror stories. She and Lewis were both big fans of Edgar Allan Poe. Horror poems, horror stories, great. They loved it. They lapped it up. They would sit for hours reading this stuff to each other, scaring each other silly. And after one of these sessions down in Bournemouth, Lewis went off to bed, and he had the dream that became Jekyll and Hyde. And Catherine was in the house in the next few days when he was going crazy writing the story. He wrote 30,000 words in 2 days, flat out. Read it to his wife, and she said, I'm not sure you've got it right. And she said, what? Furious, went in a rage, realized she got it right, threw the whole thing in the fire, and then promptly got out more pens and papers, sat and wrote another 30,000 words in another 2 days. This was a guy who was in bed having hemorrhages doing this, and out came the Jekyll and Hyde that we know. And quite astonishing. But the other interesting thing is that Catherine also wrote a horror story, which didn't get published until a lot later, 1893, the year before Lewis died. And it has certain similarities to Jekyll and Hyde. And you wonder, did she write it afterwards and just copied what her cousin did and thought, you know, that his book sold, it's a huge bestseller, I'll try the same? Or had she actually got the idea and had she been writing it a little bit beforehand?
Yeah, from the discussions and from the reading of horror stories.
And she wasn't famous. She had difficulty getting published. I can sympathize with this. And she had a row, but it was the final row that estranged Lewis, not just from her, but also from his friend and agent, if you like, the poet W.E. Henley, the one-legged man who was the original for Long John Silver, a big, burly, bearded chap with one leg. What happened was that Catherine had written a story which she couldn't get published. And Henley, who was an editor, had been trying all over the place to get a publisher to accept this story and was really fed up that none of them were taking it because nobody knew who Catherine Stevenson was. And Fanny Osborne knew about this story. Catherine had probably read it to them or whatever. And she said, I like the idea. Well, look, if you really can't get it published, would you mind if I tried writing a story like that myself, you know, used the idea? And Catherine, being a polite Scottish girl, not used to all this sort of forward American kind of, you know, you wouldn't mind this, would you? Didn't say, no, go away, it's my story. She said, well, maybe yes, you know, that would be yes, okay, you know. That was all Fanny needed. And a couple of years later, once she and Lewis had left Scotland for good and they were living in Saranac up in New York State, in the States, he was writing The Master of Ballantrae, and she wrote this story, which was very similar to the one that Catherine had written and couldn't get published. But Lewis was a hugely best-selling author. He could sell anything that he cared to write to Scribner's Magazine. They would pay him shed loads of money. No trouble, you know, there we go. And if he said, would you like to publish a short story by my wife? She writes as well. Yeah, we'll take it. So this story appears in Scribner's Magazine, which is international in the States and in the UK, with the byline, Mrs. Robert Lewis Stevenson. And Henley, back in London, saw this, and he was furious. And unfortunately, Henley was truthful and not particularly tactful, and he wrote to Lewis saying, I saw the story. I couldn't believe it. It's Catherine's, isn't it? Why there wasn't at least a double byline on it, I don't know, but surely, you know, it's Catherine's story. And Lewis, who was, you know, had a great sense of honor and the need to protect his wife, went bananas, and he wrote back saying, you know, how dare you cast aspersions on my wife? You're accusing her of plagiarism. If you don't retract immediately, that's the end of our friendship. And Henley, of course, being truthful, said, well, look, I'm terribly sorry. I'm going to upset you. I didn't want to upset you. Please accept my apologies for all the grief that I've caused you, you know, you and your wife. But he wouldn't say she didn't steal the story, because she did. Now, if you want to say, did Stevenson steal Jekyll and Hyde? No, the stories aren't similar enough. But certainly his wife had form in that area, if you like.
That's interesting. And talk about a strained relationship between his cousin and his wife. So this book that is out, it's available for free as an ebook from the...
My book, yes. It's called Lamplit Vicious Fairyland. It's 198,000 words. I should warn people, this is probably why publishers are queuing up not to publish it. It's it's unavailable in any good bookshop anywhere. In fact, you can't even get it in bad bookshops, but you can get it on the Robert Louis Stevenson website, which is www.robert-louis-stevenson.org, and it won't cost you a penny.
That's great. And a book like of that size definitely needs to be an ebook.
it's in bite-sized PDF files, so you can read as many or as few of the 28 chapters, I think it is, if you like.
And one thing that's been getting mentioned about it is that is in the book, right? This whole thing about Stevenson having had syphilis, which when you do a search for your name, this turns up. People are very excited about it. Do you know why people are so excited about this particular piece of information and not some of the other stuff you've uncovered?
Perhaps they're envious. Perhaps they're wondering what it's like to have syphilis. Wish they had it. It's to do with sex. Of course, it excites interest. It excites particular interest with Stevenson because he was a children's writer. He is always thought to be Mr. Squeaky Clean. The interesting thing is that when you look at his life, his unhappy life in many ways, as a young man in Edinburgh, I mean, you either had to smile sweetly at all these nice girls that your parents asked around to the house trying to find you a wife. And if you took any great interest in them, then, you know, the sound of wedding bells was happening already. But if you wanted any experience of women other than that, and nice girls didn't, you went to a brothel, and there were lots and lots and lots of them in Edinburgh. 200 that the police knew about. Fly prostitution by servants, factory girls, married women whose husbands didn't give them enough housekeeping money. You know, this was the unlovely side of Edinburgh. And if you went into brothels in those days, you were highly likely to get venereal disease, syphilis. And if you got syphilis, it was bad news because there were no antibiotics. You had it for life. He describes all his symptoms at the time that he got it. He describes them in a letter to his friend, Mark's private. It's clearly something that he's embarrassed about. People say, oh, he had TB. Well, we're not even sure he did have TB. He certainly didn't have TB then, and he wouldn't have been embarrassed about TB. And if you look through the letters following, it's classic symptoms of early stage syphilis. He ended up possibly because his parents didn't want folk to see him if his face had marks on it. He went to convalesce in a hotel in Malvern with his mother and then came back and he walked back into this unholy row with his parents over religion and him not being a Christian and had a hell of a year. He had a nervous breakdown. He ended up in the south of France convalescing, where his symptoms, again, all kinds of peculiar things, but again, consistent with syphilis. At the end of the day, he didn't die of tuberculosis or hemorrhages. He hadn't been having chest hemorrhages in Samoa. The amazing thing was that all that had healed up. He died suddenly, unexpectedly, of a stroke. And it could have been from overwork or stress, which is what people usually say, but one of the other things that could carry you off was a syphilitic stroke. It weakened your blood vessels in your brain, pop. That was it. And that was how he died.
Is there anything you take away from Stevenson as a human being that you think, man, after years of doing the research and writing the book, that you thought has changed your life in some way or changed the way you look at the world?
The thing that I find inspirational about Stevenson is his philosophy of his life, his code, if you like, which he formulated when he was a little kid. And he once said when somebody came in the afternoon and he'd been playing on his own, and he said, I've been making myself happy all day long. And this developed into his code of honor, if you like, that people have a duty to be happy. I mean, yeah, we know life is terrible. We know life is bad. We know there are dreadful things happening in life. Okay, well, you can go around with a long face. You can indulge yourself with depression. You can sort of sink into the morass, or you can tap dance over the top. He said, you have a duty to be happy and to spread it to other people. And, you know, yeah, I know life is bad. The number of near-death experiences he had with hemorrhages were unbelievable. He was at death's door and hauled back time and time and time again. You couldn't tell him about bad things happening to him. But he said always, your duty is to be happy. And I feel humbled by that and try to follow the maxim.
Thanks, Jeremy. You can download his biography of Robert Louis Stevenson on the Robert Louis Stevenson Society site. Search for his name or the book title, Lamplit Vicious Fairyland. We're going to close the podcast today with a tune from another cross-disciplinary writer. This is Luke Beasley, and I read with him when I was in Brisbane. He's a great poet, and he also plays music under the name New Archer. You can get a copy of his EP, the poetically titled Bees Nudge the Mouth of a Feathered Rose, over on the Bandcamp site. And you can learn more about Luke's writing and other work on his own website, which is lukebeasley.com. And here's a song called Philly.
In 2 short years, our words have slipped. Now in 5 minutes, I'll take the mare down to reach her. Don't be long in there. Watch out for carpet snakes. How old are these pears? They're the same color as the foal. I've got a filly in my chest. When you get the papers, babe, I get a filly in my chest. I've got a filly in my chest. When you get the papers, babe, I get a filly on my chest. Don't be long there. Watch out for carpet. How old are these pears? The same color as the foal. I've got a filly in my chest. When you get the papers, babe, I get a filly on my chest. I've got a filly my chest. When you get the papers, babe, I get a filly on my chest.
Casting pots of wonder and amazement.